Welcome to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Joyous conversations about what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about our one reality. You have nothing to fear. You are eternal and you are perfectly loved. Knowing the truth changes everything. Now, here's Roberta.
My wonderful novel, Mike Thomas, was published by Doubleday in 1993, and it's the best novel I ever will write. So I was surprised and delighted to learn in September that it's not a novel after all. It turns out that I have spent my whole life collaborating with spirit, and I've had no idea that was what was going on. So now I'm trying to better understand the role that spirit plays in all of our lives. Welcome to Seek Reality. I'm Roberta Grimes, and our guest today is your host. Dear friends, 2015 was the most astonishing year of my life. I began it feeling completely on track, on top of the world. I had everything all figured out. After decades of doing afterlife research, I'd just spent the past 2 years experimenting with living the Gospels, and that was turning out really well. I was researching, writing, speaking, sharing with you what I was still learning, and my personal life was perfect. My husband of 43, almost 44 years now, children all doing well, grandchildren all doing wonderfully, and I have so many friends. My life a year ago was pretty much perfect. Then in February of last year, all heaven broke loose. Actually, I don't know how else to describe what happened to me, but just that way. And I'm trying to figure out how to help you understand how that felt. I'm reasonably bright and curious. I think I'm probably just about like you. I care. I want to understand things. I did well in school, but I'm not psychic. I am totally normal. In fact, almost to a fault, I'm normal. And I've spent my life assembling an evidence-based understanding of the way the greater reality works without any reference, really, to my own life or my own experiences. I was doing it as a researcher. And I reached the point a couple of years ago, where I thought I was going to spend the rest of my life just happily sharing with you what I'm learning. We're helping one another along this amazing journey. I was feeling very blessed. Then in one moment, the greater reality that I'd been studying for all of my life from the outside unexpectedly opened up and it swallowed me whole. I began to be what I had been studying. Think how that would feel. Suddenly, my whole private life is part of the afterlife evidence. And now, I find myself feeling forced to re-examine everything that ever has happened to me, ever. I'm coming to suspect that from now on, I'm no longer entitled to protect even a zone of privacy because my whole life has become a part of the afterlife evidence. Or on the other hand, maybe this is just a variant of normal. I can hope. Are things like this happening in your life too? I've already shared with you the events around the publication of Liberating Jesus, and I'm going to a different place today than simply talking about that book. I want to talk about what we're learning about the greater reality that we didn't know before, how what's happened to me fits in, and what's really going on. What is it? Why does this time feel so different than all other times? Because it is just that much different. I'm going to share all of that with you, but to give myself a frame for my part in it, I've got to tell you again briefly how Liberating Jesus came about. I've always known I had a spirit guide, or at least for many years I have. He spoke to me when I was 8 and again when I was 20, just to let me know he was there. So I knew that there was this presence in my life, but I never wanted to know any more about him than that. Then one day, this was February of 2015, close to a year ago, one day he broke into a reading I was having with my family on the family farm. This is a little side note, but my family, both sides of my family are all Danes, and most of them farmers. I'm only barely second generation or even first generation American. And my grandfather was a dairy farmer who has established an enormous dairy farm on level 3 of the afterlife. And there, my whole extended family gathers whenever I want to talk to them. They all show up on the farm. And they told me the last time we spoke that they're going to be giving me my party on that farm, although they said it's not going to happen quite yet, which, you know, in some ways it's a disappointment, but in many ways it's, of course, not. Anyway, I was enjoying my time with my family when my friend, Suzanne Wilson, who was the medium facilitating the party that we were having, said, "Oh, your spirit guides are here and they want to talk to you." So I said, "Sure, of course, bring it on." I mean, I was a little curious about them, but it wasn't important to me to talk to them. Turns out I have 11. I have 10 guides who are sort of, as Suzanne says, there for a season or a reason, are helping me with various aspects of my work and my life, and I have a primary guide, as we all do. He was the last one to step forward, and he said, "You may call me Thomas." This, of course, came through Suzanne. Now, when they say, "You may call me," what they're saying is, this isn't my name. We all have an eternal name, but I know you're going to think of me by this name, so use this name. Sometimes our spirit guides will say, "Give me a name and I'll answer to it. Whatever you want to call me is what I'll answer to." But he told me to call him Thomas, and immediately I said, "Thomas Jefferson." I already knew on some level who he was. And my friend Suzanne said, "Oh, my God, he's telling me that you're right. That's who he is." I don't know how I knew, but I've had a strong affinity for Thomas Jefferson for most of my life. I had written, of course, that novel, My Thomas, about him, and had done a lot of research about him, and actually had found myself defending him to some Jefferson scholars who I think didn't understand, why would they, the impact that his wife had on his life and the fact that you're dealing with two different people before and after her death. So I was prepared for him to be Thomas Jefferson. Of course, I was a groupie. This is why he didn't want me to know who he was, if he could possibly avoid it. He knew I would act like a teenage groupie, and I did. And I could sort of see him rolling his eyes, even though I didn't actually see it. We had a contentious conversation then and again in May, because I was trying to get him to help me rehabilitate Thomas Jefferson. He should not even need rehabilitation, really. And he's so over that lifetime, he didn't even want to talk about Thomas Jefferson. There was one meeting I had with him and Suzanne, and I had asked her a question about that lifetime. "Would you please just ask him for me this question?" And when she asked it, he said, "Look, if this is going to be about him, I'm leaving." So we didn't talk about Thomas Jefferson. The reasons why he's unhappy with that lifetime have to do primarily with the way he handled power, which is why he says he needed one more lifetime before he could stop incarnating. But he's very, very hard on himself, just as we all are hard on ourselves. Once we have graduated, we are very judgmental of the people we were. And that's something to remember now as you go about your day. Don't give yourself any more things than necessary that you're going to be berating yourself for when you see them in your life review. Anyway, so he proceeded to tell me over the next couple of months more about what was at stake, and it was only then that I realized that he probably for at least a year had been trying to get me to write Liberating Jesus. I mean, it was a perfectly natural thing. I realize now everything I've ever done in my life has been leading up to this, and he's guided me through all of it. But when he then broached the subject, it's time to start doing a book about Christianity and Jesus, and I was, no way was I going to write that book. I'm not me. I had written appendices to The Fun of Dying and The Fun of Staying in Touch that included a lot of information about the consistencies between what the dead say and what Jesus said. There's plenty. I shouldn't have to do more than that. I should tell you, of course, that our primary guides and often other guides with them will meet with us during the night. Our minds never sleep. While our bodies are sleeping, our minds generally astral travel, and one of the things they often do is to meet with our spirit guides. Mine meet in a big conference room. Yours may meet under a tree. It doesn't really matter where you meet with them, and I think they often will allow us to choose where the meetings will happen, but we get their guidance during the night. You might think of it as they're our coach, right? And we're the team, and when our bodies are awake, we're on the field and we're doing the passes or whatever kind of team sport we're playing. Then when we sleep, it's like halftime, and we go off field. And we consult with our coaches, and they give us guidance, and they help us, and then they, you know, give us a pat on the butt, send us back on the field. So it was during those meetings that Thomas had first tried to get me to write Liberating Jesus, and I had refused to do it. I don't know how long this had been going on, but by the time I met him in the daylight during that first reading with Suzanne, he was very worked up, very intense, telling me I had to do this for him. And then when I still was reluctant, saying that the master needed me to do it. Now, I should just say parenthetically that the master is the way the dead refer to Jesus. I don't recall ever seeing him referred to as Jesus or as the Lord or anything like that. They all call him the master. And between you and me, the master is revered in the afterlife. The master is much more important in the afterlife levels than he is to any church on the face of the earth. He is revered. There are two beings who are most revered. One is Jesus, one is the Buddha, and Jesus comes first. So when they're saying, I've got to do this for the master, I understand I just don't have an option. So I told Thomas I would try. And we actually had fun in the beginning writing Liberating Jesus. He just made me feel really smart. There was the table of contents in my mind. He was giving me the words, the ideas, all in order. It was easy, fun. I wrote the first part of it with him putting the ideas in my mind, but I was shaping a lot of the words, and it was fun. Then one day, it was the 9th of June of 2015, I got an email from Suzanne. She said that Thomas had seized her in a Walmart parking lot and asked her to give me a message, which was, we apologize, the energy will be much stronger because you are working directly for the master now without the benefit of filters that would slow the transmission. Please let us know if it overwhelms the physical. And I think that was almost word for word what he said. I'm not reading it. And all of this is amazing when you think about it. And for a researcher in this field to suddenly find yourself in the middle of something related to the afterlife and the people there and stuff was fascinating for me. I mean, just that one couple, three sentences, whatever, however many he spoke, I could take that apart and parse it and apply other areas of afterlife evidence to it and get so much out of it. Benefit of filters, lowering, you know, but the vibration will be higher and working directly for them. I mean, what does all of that mean? I didn't even really much think about it before I went to bed. It was late in the day. And then I didn't really think about it till 2 o'clock in the morning when I woke up desperate to write and with a whole new energy going on. And in 2 weeks, Jesus wrote 3,000 words plus. I knew it was Jesus. Thomas had said so, but it was certainly a very different, much stronger entity. And Thomas had sort of been a collaborator in my mind. I just felt really smart. He was giving me all the ideas. I was shaping them. It was easy, but it was primarily in my own voice. When Jesus took over, he was writing as if he were me, because the whole book is written from my perspective in a way, but he was writing it. I mean, my fingers couldn't even keep up with what he was doing. I hardly was paying attention to what we were writing. But I saw little bits of it and saw that, and occasionally I would try to go back and read, but usually if I was at my computer, he wanted me to be writing. It was overwhelming. It's an experience I'm still trying to process. I tell people it was a harrowing experience, and in a way, that's really the right word for it. But we did it. And when we did it, I immediately, and then he was gone. One morning I woke up, this presence wasn't there anymore. I felt like a spent balloon. And Thomas didn't come back till that afternoon. It was a terrible day for me without having any guidance at all. And during that time, I emailed Suzanne and said, none of that happened. This is not real. And she said, funny you should say that. The Unity, that's the group around Jesus, has asked to vet your book. Will you please send it to me? And I said, okay. I mean, it seemed like a good idea to get the experts to take it apart and parse it and fix it, because I was sure it wasn't right. I couldn't believe that the master would say the things that are said in Liberating Jesus. And in a way I could, but it was still hard to believe we were going to have to say it so boldly. For I think it was 3 or 4 days, I didn't hear from Suzanne. Then I got an email from her with 3 formatting changes, which actually helped. Moving some things to an appendix, that sort of thing. And then nothing else. No word changes. I emailed back to her and I said, what do they want me to change in the book? And I didn't get an immediate answer, but an hour or so later I got the answer, just they don't want you to change a thing. And the Unity wants you to know that the Master says, well done, good and faithful servant. So then I cried. I mean, I cried because that's a very important passage in Liberating Jesus, that he knew that, Jesus knew that would be very important to me to hear him say that. But I also cried because I mean, they really have to publish this. I can't get out of it. They're not going to let me off the hook. I had a terrible summer because even as we were arranging, and Thomas chose the publisher, who's turned out to be extraordinary, frankly, and Thomas chose the publisher. Thomas figured out how they were going to publicize their book, and he got all mellow come late summer. I was more and more obsessed. Finally, I said to him aloud, I said, look, I can't do this unless you hold my hand for the rest of my life. Immediately then, I was at peace, and I've been at peace ever since. So whatever he did, he made himself more available somehow. I have not any idea what he's done, but I feel very tight now with the truth, and I feel guided, so I'm okay. In September, we had a scheduled reading, Suzanne and I, with just Thomas, because we were getting ready. The book was actually coming out. It came out October 1st, and I needed some guidance, so I had arranged to have a conversation with him, and he was just as mellow as you can imagine. He was a totally different guy than the one I'd met in February. Very relaxed and happy. Suzanne said he was smiling. It was very nice. And he even materialized. They can do this. It takes a lot of energy, but he materialized in her office, so she was able to tell me he's 6 feet tall and this and that. He doesn't, by the way, look remotely like Jefferson. He doesn't have that identity at all now. He has kept the identity from his most recent lifetime. So he is, you know, shorter and less fancy by a long shot, and just a regular farmer guy. He shows up in a blue work shirt and dark work pants. That's how he thinks of himself. He probably always thought of himself as a plain man, and he took the Jefferson lifetime as a challenge. I think he did well with it, but he feels he could have done better. Anyway, that's another story for another time. He was very mellow in September, and he started to tell us things he never had told us before. He said that, yes, I had agreed before I was born to come in. He and I had 17 lifetimes together. I was in his Jefferson lifetime at the end of it. I have some memories of that. He was an old man, and I was a young male protege. I think I was Richard Rush, but he won't confirm that. But anyway, perfectly acceptable and sensible, the things he was saying about how I had agreed to do it. And yes, I don't mind at all. I'm happy. I think it's a very useful way to spend my life, trying to do this. Then he said it got more interesting in the 1980s, because he had been preparing me all my life, and then came a decision by the Master in 1980 that he was going to give his new revelation, and he needed a clean vessel in which to do it. Thomas put me forward. The problem was, of course, no one knew if I could channel. Thomas was preparing me and hoping I would be able to channel when it was time for me to write his book, but they couldn't mess around when they were preparing someone to write for the Master. So that was when this extremely private man, Thomas Jefferson, he burned all his letters to his wife, all her letters to him, all her papers. He never talked about her except toward the end of his life, and his wife died when he was 39. The Thomas Jefferson from before her death, and the Thomas Jefferson who went on to do all the things, I mean, everything except the Declaration of Independence was written by this different man. He was destroyed by Martha's death in ways that Jefferson scholars really don't, I think, appreciate. I've argued with some of them, and they can see it when I point it out, but they don't understand. We're not dealing. He was a broken man after she died, and he was only 39. And he went on to live a consolation life that included all the great things he did and being president, third president of the United States, everything. There was no Sally Hemings affair. Anybody who goes and does the research will be able to see that. It makes perfect sense to me. When he was about 80 years old, he said that his marriage had been 10 years of uncheckered happiness and that Martha had been the cherished companion of his life. She had been dead then for more than 40 years. And think about it. 10 years of uncheckered happiness. He spent that whole 10 years fighting the revolution, and he was very active in fighting the revolution. So all of that was forgotten, though. All he remembered was who was by his side. So this is such a very important time of his life. What's extraordinary to me is that he said, okay, I'll prove to you she can channel, and he used a part of his own life as Jefferson to do it. Easy for him to do, of course. He would have remembered that time very well, and our memories are much stronger as are our and he has access to the life review he would have had after the Jefferson lifetime, much more powerful mind, and probably enough distance then that he wanted us to know him as he had been when she was alive. As I say, he was a different, much gentler man then. So he guided me through doing the research, and it was easy, and it was fun. It was terrific. I loved it. I even went to Monticello. People were telling me all these things I could never have learned otherwise. He said later that he was the one who had made them say those things. But anyway, I had a wonderful time doing the research. I sat down at my computer, didn't even know what the first scene would be, and I raced right through the whole book. It's written in Elizabethan English. I don't think I even edited it after it was finished. It was perfect. It came out perfectly. I said, before it even had a title, I sent it to my agent. I had an agent at the time, and she immediately sent it to someone very high up at Doubleday who immediately bought it. So I didn't get the chance to tone down the Elizabethan English. But I wanted to after they bought it. I wasn't allowed to. But if you find a Doubleday edition of My Thomas from 1993, you'll see that she says things like fain and withal and some very quaint things. I wouldn't have known how to write that. I feel like a fool that I ever thought I could have written that book. I'm also amazed, as I say, that he would write it. But apparently I proved then that I could channel. Lo and behold, Doubleday allowed the book to die. Devastating for me at the time, but I understand now why. It was not the right time for it to come out. Now it is the right time, apparently, for it to come out, and Thomas has blessed a foreword to it, which says the role that he played in putting that book together. Effectively now we have Thomas Jefferson's memoir of his life during the Revolution. What does all this mean? I'll tell you after I take a little break what I think it means. This is Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. My nonfiction books are Liberating Jesus, The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, Flying High in Spirit, and it turns out also My Thomas. You can learn about all my books and find my blog at robertagrimes.com. Now, our guest today is your host, and we're talking about the fact that my life has suddenly become public. It's become public because everything that's happened since I was a tiny child turns out to be more evidence. To call it afterlife evidence doesn't really do justice to what it is that, quote, afterlife researchers are really studying now, because we have two sources of truth in our society. One is science and one is religions. They say that they're giving us material truth and spiritual truth. Neither is right about that. Science is not giving us material truth. in part because nothing is material, and they know that. Everything is energy. And they won't go there for the simple fact that they consider themselves to have to be atheist. And when what you're studying is nothing but God, to be an atheist is to be a blind fool. I think that's pretty obvious. But it's going to take a pretty good hard hit to the head for scientists to begin to study what actually is going on. So then our other source of truth, of course, is religion. Let's take Christianity. Christianity is the first century variant of Judaism. That's really what it is. It hasn't been allowed to change at all since then. So it's not really spiritual in that it doesn't address spirituality. It's a set of beliefs which are not founded in any kind of fact. The only way, of course, to break through the hold that religions have on our lives is to open the gift that we have intact from Paul and actually apply the teachings of Jesus. And that's becoming very important now. Let's step back a bit more and understand how all of the story I've told you about my own life fits with something bigger, of which you probably are a part. I mean, when we focus on just me, we're focusing on this little pixel in this enormous tapestry. Each of us, a pixel, a stitch, each of us has one little part to play there. Mine is not any bigger than yours. The part you're to play is something that it's up to you to discover and then to grow in and then to perform. I urge you to get to know your primary guides. Do whatever you can to grow spiritually, because this is a war that's going to take all of us on the field in order to basically save humankind, save the earth. That's really what's at stake now. This is a process that seems to have begun at the very end of the 19th century and coming forward. I don't know when exactly they decided that they had to wake us up, but they decided back then that they needed to do it. I think there's some indication that the quantum physics and the earliest communications, good communications we were receiving from the dead in the very first part of the 20th century were meant to coincide, one illuminating the other. But of course we know that science reacted badly to that idea, so the greatest pioneers of quantum physics were largely ignored in the things they said about spirituality. Max Planck found God. It's just that simple. And all of that was ignored. While they revere the man for his quantum physics work, they don't revere him for the greater work that he also did in helping us to come to understand the greater reality. So come the latter part of the 1930s and into the early 40s, as the world was going to war, it seems that at the highest level of reality, the plan was forming to fix the world. Why was that important? Simply put, I think, and I've only seen this somewhere, but it makes sense. The reason they were so afraid is that there was another planet somewhere in the solar system, and yes, the universe teems with life. Not somewhere in the solar system, somewhere in the universe. The universe teams with life. There are a lot of extraterrestrials. There are some here. In fact, we're being protected by extraterrestrials. But all of the people near this planet, or virtually all of them, who are not human, are cloaked. They're not in human bodies. They're in what we think of as the afterlife, slightly higher vibratory levels of reality, because they're afraid of us. And that's pathetic when you think about it. But nonetheless, they don't want us to see them. They don't want us to attack them. But putting that aside, there was, at the very highest level of reality, there began to be engineered this plan. The oldest people I know who are doing research in this field are in their mid-70s, thereabouts. And there are a number of them who were born in the latter part, which means they were born around 1940. There are a number of people who were born in the latter part of the 40s and into the 50s. Part of it, you may be as well, but I was born 1 year after they exploded the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the fact that we would use atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, in anger really freaked them out at the highest level. You cannot imagine. I'm having trouble imagining just how much of an alarm it was for them, but it was an alarm. And that was when they decided they had to begin to raise our vibration, raise the consciousness of the whole planet, and get us past warfare. Jesus had already tried once to help us know how to bring the kingdom of God on earth, and that was, as we know, in the year zero, early part of this millennium, or the millennium, the previous millennium. He came to earth and he gave us the teachings of that are in the Gospels, preserved beautifully today. And we didn't pay attention to the teachings. We instead, we being humankind, put the teachings inside a first century version of Judaism, and that's where they've stayed all this time. It is ironic that in the afterlife, the Master is so revered, and here people who call themselves followers of Jesus really don't take seriously his teachings, because the religion itself gives them a shortcut. All they have to do is claim him as their savior, and they go right to the head of the line, so why bother to learn anything here? Tragic that that's what the religion teaches them. And in fact, it's not true. There's no evidence anywhere that God ever has judged anyone, or anybody else who was a religious figure has ever judged anyone. And there's no evidence that the death of Jesus on the cross has ever redeemed anyone from anything. It's just not. It's a Christian story, but it's not based in fact. The beauty of studying the afterlife evidence is that we now can begin to talk about what is actually factual, independently factual, and what is just a story that was told 2,000 years ago by people who didn't know any better. They did the best they could. But this begins to answer a big question that I've always had, which is, why now? Why have we suddenly, beginning in the latter part of the 19th century, been given so much better information about the afterlife? It's taken probably 100 years for people to put this together. It really wasn't until the early part of the 21st century that we were able to make sense of it all. And we even are only now making sense of it from the perspective of people who are living in the greater reality and not, we don't, it's more complicated by far than what we've come to put together, but what we've put together is kind of pretty sensible, and it fits, and the new evidence that keeps coming in fits with what we've learned, so it's all very encouraging. But why were we given that information? I think it's pretty clear from what Jesus says in Liberating Jesus that we were given the information so that we would get past the religion and also see confirmed the teachings of the man. It's a genuine miracle. I'll explain that in a minute, but let's talk about what he tried first. In the latter part of the 60s, for about 7 years, there was a glorious, amazing set of books channeled, and they're called A Course in Miracles. I recommend A Course in Miracles strongly. Jesus says that he led that group, which is why they called themselves J, the group who channeled A Course in Miracles. But that was, of course, another myth, right? I mean, when he spoke to people 2,000 years ago, they were too primitive to understand how the value of the teachings and what he was really saying. And you can see his frustration about that even 2,000 years later in the Gospels. But that didn't work. So the second attempt then was when he tried to use a Course in Miracles. But that was wrong in the other direction. It went right over our heads. It was... He tried to be simple for the first century folks, then he tried to be more sophisticated for us, but it was another myth. So the third time he attempted this, that I know of, there could have been others, but what he tried to do was to give us the things that the dead tell us about the afterlife, God, reality, death, the afterlife, and the meaning and purpose of human life, those things are validated by a modern English translation of the Gospels. Stop and think about what an amazing thing that is. He spoke Aramaic. His words were translated into Greek and from Greek into modern languages. If you take a direct translation from Aramaic into English, it's not perfectly accurate in terms of the afterlife evidence. But if you take the Revised Standard Version, New American Study Bible, there are several modern translations, which if you take them, and these translators did their best they could, but if you take one and you put it beside what the dead are telling us, you find they match. They match. That's not possible if it's not divinely inspired. It's not possible. So what Jesus did was to first make sure we got the evidence from the dead. That's why they turned the spigot on 100 plus years ago. And that there would be people inspired to put it all together. That's why some of us have felt driven to do this. And then once it's put together, he made sure that these translations, which were done in the 20th century, all were consistent in their details with what the dead are telling us. That's not a coincidence. That's a miracle. If you think you've never witnessed a miracle, that is a miracle. There's no other way to put it. It has to have been the work of God. And so this time what he's saying is, look, I can show you that the religion that you have packaged my teachings in isn't real. Here's real. And I can also show you that my teachings are real. Here's the evidence. It's real. So to even have figured all of this out feels kind of exciting and amazing to me. What does it mean? It means that we have come to a new stage in our understanding of what's really going on. And I'm not the only one doing it. There are key people all over the world who are working on this. I'm in contact with a lot of them. And I learn from them every day. I mean, Mikey Morgan is part of this a raising of the consciousness of the planet. And he had not been on Earth since the 1600s, so he needed to be here briefly, was chose a 20-year lifetime. His mother says, I never would have signed up for this. But unfortunately, she indeed signed up for it. And fortunately for us, however, and I think she's beginning to feel proud to be able to help her son, even though she would prefer, you know, not every gift is a good gift. A lot of gifts are terrible to receive, but it's a gift just the same. Mikey's life was a gift to us all because he came back, he learned enough about our culture and the way to express himself to us today, and he went back then to his home, which is in the upper part of the sixth level, almost at the source level, where when he's at home, it's not that he just wears slippers. He doesn't usually wear a body anymore. He's a light being. And yet he can communicate with us as a 20-year-old boy living in, you know, the year he died, 2007. That's all part of this whole process. I don't know what's going to best, you know, resonate with you. It may be the teachings of Jesus, and it may be something else. I mean, it may be T.J. Woodward's extraordinary book, Conscious Being, which I recommend highly to anybody who's interested in really trying to understand what's going on, because he reaches all the same places, but he doesn't use the Gospels to get there. Jesus said when one of his disciples, John, the disciple that he loved, complained to him, these people are casting out demons, master and teacher, and they're not using your, you know, basically, they're not using your methods. They're not doing it in your name. We tried to get them to stop. Jesus said, don't stop them. Whoever is not against us is with us. Jesus himself allowed that there probably are many ways to get to this place. And he says the same in A Course in Miracles. This is one way to get there. Well, I'm here to tell you personally that the easiest way to get there is the Gospels. I don't think there could be an easier way. I began in the spring of 2011 because people were asking me. I was just beginning to do talks about the fun of dying, which, by the way, was also channeled. I've never written a blessed thing on my own, and I'm accepting that now. Took me a minute, but I was starting to talk about the fun of dying, and people would say to me, well, but do the teachings of Jesus work? Because there's an appendix, of course, which talks about the teachings of Jesus. And I would have to say, I bet they do. But I decided I ought to find out, because that's only sensible and only fair. If I'm telling people, do this thing, I ought to be able to tell them it works. So I decided in shortly after the first of the year in 2011 to do it, to go in there and to figure out exactly how to live the teachings and to live them and to see if it works. And I have to tell you, it should be harder. It's really, really not hard. It's easy. In retrospect, it seems to have taken very little time before I noticed major changes in myself. 5 years later, which is what it's coming up to be now, I can't even, it's hard for me to even explain to you how deep the changes are. I always knew there would be three books in the Fun series. The titles came to me, I woke up in the morning one morning shortly before The Fun of Dying was published, and I knew what the titles were supposed to be, but I didn't know even then what The Fun of Staying in Touch would be about, and I certainly didn't know what The Fun of Growing Forever would be about. Now I do. The Fun of Growing Forever, which will come out in 2017, is going to explain to you how, what the easiest possible way is to use modern life to ace and get right to the fifth level, right above the fifth level. You can do it in one lifetime. People now are doing what the Buddhists call turning on wheel. They're having lifetime after lifetime, because until we reach the upper part of the fifth level, we crave spiritual growth. If you take every hunger you have ever had in your life, food, sex, happiness, you know, a new car, whatever you've ever wanted in your life, if you put all those hungers together and multiply them by 1,000, that's how much you're going to crave spiritual growth when you're in the afterlife levels. And it's so hard to do there that until you reach mid to upper fifth level, you're going to want to come back. I know you don't think that. Oh, I'll never come back here. You will. And you'll do it eagerly, because from there it doesn't seem like a big deal. What seems to us like a lifetime here seems like a minute to them there. So if you don't want to keep coming back, a very good way to prevent that or minimize the risk of it is to begin to take the teachings of Jesus as seriously as he means them to be taken. And so I'm going to try to help you do that. I think that's what I'm supposed to be doing for the rest of my life. There are many people who can teach about the afterlife, and I'm happy to do that too. But a lot of spiritual teachings that we're getting are not really spiritual now. They're not based in truths given to us by eternal beings, and they don't resonate with the truth. So it's very important in your trying to grow spiritually that you do it in a way that's going to work and be effective. There may be more effective ways than the teachings of Jesus, but I cannot imagine what they are, because you don't have to learn to meditate, which I can't do. You don't need yoga. You don't need chanting. You don't have to go to any place and listen to somebody talking to you. You can transform yourself by yourself just with the teachings of Jesus. Now, to me, I'm too impatient to do anything else. The fact that it worked for me is and still continues to work is astonishing to me. I mean, I remember the things that would upset me 5 years ago. Things could ruin my day. I think I still have the levers that those events would sort of pull on me and it would cause this reaction. And they still seem to pull the levers. It's just that I don't react. None of that, everything's disconnected on the inside somehow. I it's hard to explain it. And as I begin to work on writing The Fun of Growing Forever, I'll probably talk with you more about the process. But please be clear on this. You can change the way you are. And you can do it simply by allowing the teachings of Jesus to perform that magic for you. It's the surest way for you to become happy in this lifetime, happier than I can even describe to you. But what maybe is important to you and to many people it's going to be more important is that each person who goes through this process and transforms his or her life with the teachings, whether it's Conscious Being by T.J. Woodward or the Gospels as Jesus asks us to edit them to take out the later stuff, and Liberating Jesus can do that with you. However you do it, when you have begun to transform your life, you have begun to transform the world. This is a very important thing to understand. The way the dead at the highest levels of reality are transforming our world is by giving us the means to transform ourselves. People will say to me, well, what about ISIS? You're not doing anything about ISIS. Oh, yes, we are. When enough people have transformed their own lives and become the more advanced beings spiritually that we all have the power to become, when enough people have done that, it will transform every human being on the face of the earth. You don't ever need to talk to ISIS about the teachings of Jesus. It won't help you anyway. But the day will come, I think it's 10 or 15%. I don't think it's more than that. When enough people on earth have reached a sufficiently high level of spiritual development, everybody on earth will begin to grow spiritually. Suddenly, what used to seem like a good idea in terms of cruelty and war and pain and suffering and all the things that people do to themselves and to each other now, it won't look like a good idea anymore. Suddenly, they'll begin to be more peaceful too. This is the only way to fix the world. There isn't another way to do it. Whatever bothers you, maybe you're upset about global warming. You can't fix it. But you can transform humankind. Once you've done that, all these problems go away, every one of them. So that's why this is worth doing. That's why I think you also have a role to play in this. All of our roles are important. We're all being called. I urge you to get to know your spirit guide if you feel inclined to do that, or at least open yourself in what you read and in what you say and do. What I found was, and I started doing this 20 years ago, when I first realized all minds are open to all other minds, your mind is open to God, there's no such thing as a private thought. I transformed my thoughts then. When you transform your thoughts, that's a great way to begin to transform your mind. Don't think anything ever again that you would mind seeing on a billboard in Times Square in a thought bubble over your face. Don't ever think any negative thought, anything, ever again. It's up to you to make this change in yourself, but it's going to make you a lot happier. I mean, if you just won't give mind space to anything negative, only positive things then can happen for you. Oh, my goodness. All right. I think I've come as far as I can this time, and I'm sorry. I would love to go on longer, but it probably wouldn't help. I think I've made my point. What's happened to me is extraordinary. I'm still processing it, but I'm coming to understand that it's part of this gigantic picture. And this, in this picture, each of us has a role to play, and it's exciting to begin to play it together. Meanwhile, this has been Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. You are a powerful, eternal being. You never began, you never will end. And when you fully grasp what that means, it's going to change everything in your life for the better. If you'd like to learn more of the amazing things that we're learning about our one reality, of course, past episodes of Seek Reality are available for free on webtalkradio.net and also on iTunes. Just search for Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. My nonfiction books are My Thomas, Liberating Jesus, The Fun of Dying, The Fun of Staying in Touch, and Flying High in Spirit. You'll find details about all my books and my blog at robertagrimes.com. Our guest next week is going to be our extraordinary friend, Dr. Gary Schwartz of the University of Arizona at Tucson. Gary is the greatest living scientist in the emerging field of afterlife experimentation. He's amazing. He's the one who wrote the afterlife experiments that came out, I think it was in 2003. Until I read it, I didn't believe in spiritual mediums, but he did experiments that convinced me that they're real. I saw him in September, and I said to him, hey, what about coming back on Seek Reality and telling us what's new in your laboratory? But he turned the tables on me. He had read Liberating Jesus in manuscript. He is not someone, of course, from a Christian background. You can tell that by his name. But he's really from an atheist kind of background. So all of the stuff he's learning is really news to him. He loved Liberating Jesus, and he decided what he wants to do is interview me about this book. So I'll be trying to interview him, and he'll be trying to interview me, and whenever Gary and I get together, things are tend to get very funny. So our podcast next week is going to be a joy for me to record, and I think it'll be a joy for you to hear. Please join us. Today, I've shared with you the most intimate part of my life as if it were just more afterlife evidence, in the hope that the magic and the joy of serving spirit is going to resonate in your life as well. It's very important that you understand that there is an effort being engineered right now at the highest levels of reality to elevate the consciousness of this planet and fast, and to initiate the kingdom of heaven on earth. Jesus says right in the Gospels, that's why he came, that if we follow him, that's what will happen. And in fact, it's meant to begin to happen now. We're all being called to become more deeply engaged with spirit. I didn't know even a year ago, and I'll be 70 in the summer, I didn't even know a year ago what my role was really supposed to be. You don't know yet what yours is, but I'll bet yours is wonderful too. And when you find it and begin to live as you always had meant to live when you were not yet in body, you're going to be happy as you never, ever have been happy before. So I hope that you'll begin to think about that and understand all you need to do is prepare and watch. You don't know the hour. You don't know what your own part in this work is going to be, but it's going to be made plain to you, and it's going to be amazing. For now, though, please enjoy and make the most of this coming week in hour one reality, knowing that you are a powerful, eternal being, and you are infinitely loved.
You've been listening to Seek Reality with Roberta Grimes. Roberta blogs and answers questions at robertagrimes.com. Join us every week as we explore what the afterlife evidence and modern science combine to tell us is true about the one reality we all share. Knowing the truth changes everything.